And I'd like to invite those of you who are going to first dinner to leave the room. Those of you who are going to first dinner. Actually, I thought there could be a sort of seamlessness between these sessions, since we're discussing many of the same issues. Racism does certainly emerge from the writings of ethnic women in the United States. I've taught ethnic writers as women writers as a separate course twice, once during a January term and again most recently this spring. And the four ethnic groups that are usually considered in such courses are African American, Asian American, American Indian, or Native American, whichever is your preference, and Chicanas. So in the course, I felt I could only cover three. I left out Asian Americans that time, and today I'm not able to cover everything, so I won't emphasize Native American women, but I have bibliographic suggestions for you, and I have one poem by a Native American woman, if time permits, that we can look at. I'm going to start, as I did in my poetry session, by considering silenced women, because that's where the literary tradition begins when we discuss women from any ethnic group. I think maybe we feel sometimes that we've heard enough about these silenced women, women whom Virginia Woolf said were unnamed geniuses filled with restlessness and a yearning that she tries to describe in her book, A Room of One's Own. Genius of a sort must have existed among them, among these women, as it existed among the working classes. But certainly it never got itself onto paper. When, however, one reads of a woman possessed by the devils, of a wise woman selling herbs, or even a remarkable man who had a remarkable mother, then I think we are on the track of a lost novelist, a suppressed poet, some Emily Bronte who dashed her brains out on the moors, crazed with the torture her gift had put her to. A Room of One's Own has become a recognized classic as a treatise on the educational and hence the literary or artistic oppression that women have experienced. And it also has become a metaphor, A Room of One's Own, for precisely what women need in order to create. It sounds crass, but they need money to support themselves and space in which to write. And that space can be as simple as uninterrupted time in a room that's shared by many people, but uninterrupted space, in order to give their imaginations free range. Alice Walker is probably best known for her Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Color Purple. And in an essay of hers that's equally famous now, called In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, she takes Virginia Woolf's statements in A Room of One's Own and revises them, placing into brackets exactly what kinds of differences need to be considered if this woman is also black. One of the examples that she comes up with as a woman doubly oppressed by gender and color is Phyllis Wheatley, the 17th century poet, who was in a way privileged because her mistress on that southern plantation where she lived taught her to read and write, a rare privilege. But then Phyllis Wheatley went on to imitate poems by white British males such as Alexander Pope. She was even shipped off to England once with her poems, a sheaf of her poems in hand, to almost be trotted out like a little show, you know, to show exactly what this slave girl could do. And Alice Walker, in this essay, laments the fact that she was abused in a way. That is, she wasn't permitted to write in her own voice, with her own language. Yet she kept alive, as Walker says, the notion of song. I like that phrase because just having the notion of song within you means that someday you're going to sing that song. And that has certainly happened. I think now, after nearly 20 years of college teaching, of how my required texts have changed over that period of time. And in the 70s, certainly we were very aware of the need for this, and I began teaching women writers in the 70s. But gradually I have read and included more and more people from these different ethnic groups that we're talking about. And I have to say that I think the stories that have affected me the most, they have a special power in them, have come from these authors. I don't mean to say that white authors aren't doing good work. It's simply that some of these novelists, you've heard of them, Toni Morrison, for example, in poetry, June Jordan and Audre Lorde, African-American, Asian-American, we could read quite a litany of their names here. They have deeply affected us, and I think it's because of these experiences that we talked about in the last session, if you were here. I think most of you were here. It's those kinds of experiences, giving one a kind of double consciousness of oneself. Or as Verlaine said, I'm bicultural, I can move between two cultures. I think as a white person, I am hungry for news from those other cultures. I want to read about them, I want to know about them. And stories are the best way to hear about them. That's why this morning was so much fun in sharing all of our stories, I think. Not just fun, it was instructional, it was educational. Well, in the last 20 to 25 years, there's been a positive explosion of writing by these authors. And in Southern California, to call them minorities, I don't know about your neck of the woods, but to call these people minorities in Southern California is a misnomer, because especially as far as the Latino-Latina population is concerned, are rapidly becoming a majority. I'd like to start with one example from the Asian American community, and I've chosen poems, since we can look at the poems and discuss them best, with the exception of one novel here by an African-American, Gloria Naylor. So Mitsui Yamada is the woman I'd like to start with first. She's a woman of Japanese ancestry, and I've met her at several women's studies conferences in Southern California. She's, I believe, in her 70s now, and she taught at Cypress College for years. As a teenager, she grew up in a prosperous Japanese-American community on the West Coast, and she thought only of doing well in school and of going on to college and eventually marrying. And then suddenly her life and her dreams were rudely interrupted. During World War II, Mitsui's father gathered with a group of other men to write poetry in the evenings. Can you imagine? And they had all these little scraps of paper on which they wrote their poems. And the FBI, who were watching during World War II the activities of all Japanese Americans, became suspicious, raided the home of one of these men when they were meeting, gathered up the scraps of paper, which they could not understand because they didn't know Japanese, and put them all in jail. Then they went out and gathered up all of the members of their families and shipped them off to Idaho, to one of the internment camps. And it was so shocking to these people because they thought of themselves as Americans, not as Japanese, but they were suspect because of their Japanese ancestry and presumably their ties to Japan. In one poem, Mitsui Yamada writes of the send-off to camp. The Seattle Times photographer said, "Smile." So I obediently smiled, and the caption the next day read, "Note smiling faces, a lesson to Tokyo." So this incarceration, as most of you will recall, was interpreted by the United States as being necessary protection for the Japanese Americans, you know, rather than as some kind of injustice to them. So the first poem I'd like for us to look at is called On the Bus. It's from these camp notes. Winston, would you read this poem for us, please?
Oh, from Camp Notes.
On the Bus.
On the Bus. Who goes? Not the leaders of the people. Combed out of the left with the FBI, our father stayed behind triple locks. What was the charge? Possible espionage or impossible espionage? I forget what. Only those who remained free in prison stayed behind. The rest of us went to Camp Harmony, where the first baby was christened Melody.
Okay, good. There's some irony in this poem, isn't there? You just feel that ironic tone. Where does it creep in, do you think? I noticed that you laughed when Winston read possible espionage or impossible espionage. That's one place, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Those who remain free.
That's a contradiction, isn't it? What do you think that means? Perhaps.
If you weren't taken off to return to the camp, your life was almost like being in prison.
I think there might be another irony going on here. What is the name of this internment camp?
Camp Harmony.
You know, I mean, the internment camps, remember, were built as protection for the Japanese Americans. They were really prisons, though, weren't they? Because they caused these families to lose businesses, to lose property. I don't know if you remember that whole iteration of crimes that only, recently has been brought before the courts and some restitution has been made, maybe $10,000 or $20,000 paid as consolation for all of these losses. Families were disrupted and so on. So I think really she's playing here with the whole notion of who was behind prison, who was really behind prison bars, who really what could be accused of espionage in this case, and where did Harmony exist? You know, there's no family Harmony, is there? There's no harmony between the United States and Japanese Americans if you thrust members of that community in prison. And so the war in the larger world is really being exacerbated at home with this kind of activity. And then the first baby being christened Melody. What do you think that? Why would she include a detail like that? Right? Melody at Harmony Camp, you know. And it really, it's that taste in your mouth almost of bitterness. But instead of making her bitterness explicit, she uses these poetic images to do it. It's a very simple little poem, and yet it cuts rather deeply. Let's read the next one. Jerry, would you read that?
In the outhouse, our collective waste bin where the air sticks in my craw burns my eyes. I have this place to hide the excreta and the blood which do not flush down nor seep away. They pile up, fill the earth. I am drowning.
Again, just a few images. Very deft strokes, but what do they say, do you think? Yes, very definitely. Something about her world.
And our world, I hope.
Okay, why?
with our air and our pollution,
mm-hmm.
when we're drowning,
mm-hmm.
a world that's not water and pure.
Mm-hmm. And in the camp, she also was drowning, wasn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Drowning in poisoned air. Air becomes poisoned when you're not trusted. She has no place to hide except this outhouse. That's ironic in itself, isn't it? Because an outhouse is a particular kind of prison, yet that's her hiding place. I think of an outhouse as a prison anyway, because you're prison to all the smells and so on. You're prison to that kind of claustrophobia that you can have as a result of those. But it's a question, too, whether the line should continue there. I have this place to hide. Does that continue? The excreta and blood?
Mm-hmm.
And these do not flush away. Why not? What is it that's coming from herself that will not flush away?
Parts of her.
Parts of her. These memories of having been stuck in this place, for one. That's where the outhouse becomes a metaphor for the whole experience. Do you have a different way of seeing that, anybody?
Maybe you think about her anger.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's nowhere to go with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, her anger is confining her. There's no real way to flush it out, to channel it.
Yeah, and those words, excreta and blood, they don't. They probably go along with the idea of being just an overwhelming sense of.
Yeah, you know, blood does really connect with the passions. I guess I have a little bit more trouble with excreta here. Maybe we don't want to talk about it except when the septic tank is being cleaned. But
well, and this is so present because you have to go back to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm sure there are times she would leave her anchor, but the time you come back to it,
mm-hmm.
it comes up again.
Mm-hmm.
You have that need and.
Mm-hmm. When these poems were written, when they were published, Mitsui Yamada commented that the question of the constitutional rights of this nation's citizens during wartime still has not been resolved. And as I mentioned earlier, some of that has been resolved. And it's amazing to me that the Japanese Americans accepted, as they did, the restitution. 70,000 of the 110,000 Japanese incarcerated in camps were second-generation American citizens. So they considered themselves, I'm a second-generation Swedish American, and I've never considered myself anything but America. What if we had had a war with Sweden? I would have been rounded up. I mean, it's just preposterous to think that I was not an American citizen. That's the way I view it. A film was recently made by Light Seraph of San Francisco, which records a very tender moment between Mitsui and her daughter. In the film, Mitsui is telling her about telling the reasons that she never allowed her children to go to the stores on errands. And apparently this teenage daughter has never heard the reasons. And she said it was because she experienced all of those taunts, those insults as a child, and she didn't want her children to experience the same. So this young woman is hearing her mother's explanation of something that she could never understand as a child, and she had, of course, been outraged that her mother wouldn't give her that freedom, and she begins to cry as she realizes that it was to spare her some shame. Because Asian Americans have experienced oppression, they have avoided any foreign-looking and sounding habits in the second and third generations. I think most of us do remark upon the assimilation patterns of Asian Americans. Only recently has there been a strong cultural movement for self-affirmation among Asian Americans. And that's led to a very close look at oneself, and also it's led to publishing literature which expresses that identity. And certainly Maxine Hong Kingston's book, The Woman Warrior, has made an impact. But I wonder how many are familiar with Joyce Kagawa's book, Obasan. Have you read that? Isn't that a beautiful book? And this considers Japanese Canadians and their difficulty during World War II. It's a lyrical book. I wish I had the blackboard here. It's usually here. I counted on it being here. But Obasan is... Yes, I'm going to give you a bibliography at the end, actually. I think I'll do it now so you can write it on here. You can add this one on. Because I don't believe it's on here. This one is a little bit dated. If you'll turn the page over, there are a few Asian American writers listed there. And you could add Joyce Kagawa. I'm almost certain that it's K-A-W-A-G-A. I'm certain of the consonants, I'm not certain of the vowels. K-A-W-A-G-A. Oh, I'm sorry, K-A-G-A-W-A. And Obasan is O-B-A-S-O-N. It might be S-A-N. Is it S-A-N? Yeah, good. I'd like to turn now to a couple of African-American women writers. And I'm going to start with Gloria Naylor. Who grew up in Robbinsville, Mississippi. And during the 1940s, when her mother was living and working there, the local library was off limits for blacks. So her mother worked extra hours in the cotton fields and sent her extra money to book clubs. That was the only way that she could get a book without identifying herself by color, so she sent away for books. Gloria then grew up in a very literary home, and she's now a creative writing teacher at George Washington University, and she credits her mother for her own love affair with literature. She's an amazingly warm person. I've heard her read at one of our state universities in Southern California, and she seems like the person you'd like to sit down and have a long chat with, just very comfortable. Although she's written two books since The Women of Brewster Place was published, she's written Linden Hills and Mama Day since then. And Bailey's Cafe, three. This remains my favorite, except that I haven't read Bailey's Cafe. Jerry, do you want to give us a critique of Bailey's Cafe?
It's written well. No, I won't.
Okay, it's very good. She remembers her classical high school education, where she read the works of white males, white English males, and then for good measure, one woman writer, George Eliot, but not a black woman writer. So it wasn't until she discovered The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison in college that she knew that there were black women writing. Now, this is just amazing to me that she could have gone through all of high school without knowing that there were these black women authors. A very similar thing happened to Alice Walker. She went to Spelman and then to Sarah Lawrence, and she didn't discover Zora Neale Hurston's name until she was doing some work on voodoo in order to write a short story, and she found Zora Neale Hurston's name in a footnote in one anthropological study, and then she became the mother, really, the foremother of all African-American women writers. So the need for having an inspiring model is really great. And once all of these writers have found those models, they've taken off. This is her first published novel, and it won the American Book Group Award in 1983. That's 10 years ago now. The book interlaces the lives of 7 ordinary black women who live in a tenement building together, Brewster Place. And you get the feeling that it's a city, it takes place in a city on the East Coast. You're not quite certain which one it is. Maddie has lost a great deal in her life by the time she comes to live there. But instead of giving in to despair, she gives of herself to strengthen and encourage all the other women. And in what I regard as the most powerful vignette of this book, Maddie rescues a young friend whose name is Lucilia Turner, or Seal. She rescues her from death by self-willed silence. This woman's husband has lost his job. He has come home so despairing over the loss of this job that he accuses her of being the source of all of his problems. You know, if he didn't have women and babies to worry about, his life would be just fine. So under that kind of insult, Seal goes to get an abortion. And her 2-year-old child is playing in the family living area while she and her husband go in as he's packing up to have, you know, what it might be a very familiar marital conflict about his departure. As Serena, which is the child's name, is playing, she discovers that a cockroach is crawling into a light socket, and she finds a fork on the floor, sticks the fork in the light socket, and you've already guessed what the result is. So Seal had potentially 2 babies. Now she has none, and she is in intense pain. Maddie knows that she's going to die unless something critical takes place, because she's just wasting away. So I'd like to read just a part of this to you. Maddie stood in the doorway, and an involuntary shudder went through her when she saw Seal's eyes. "Dear God," she thought, "she's dying, and right in front of our faces." "Merciful Father, no," she bellowed. There was no prayer, no bended knee or sackcloth supplication in those words, but a blasphemous fireball that shot forth and went smashing against the gates of heaven, raging and kicking, demanding to be heard. "No, no, no!" Like a black Brahmin cow desperate to protect her young, she surged into the room, pushing the neighbor woman and the others out of her way. She approached the bed with her lips clamped shut with such force that the muscles in her jaw and the back of her neck began to ache. She sat on the edge of the bed and enfolded the tissue-thin body in her huge ebony arms, and she rocked. Seal's body was so hot it burned Maddie when she first touched her, but she held on and rocked. Back and forth, back and forth, she had Seal so tightly she could feel her young breasts flatten against the buttons of her dress. And somewhere from the bowels of her being came a moan from Seal. So high at first it couldn't be heard by anyone there, but the yard dogs began an unholy howling, and Maddie rocked. And then, agonizingly slow, it broke its way through the parched lips in a spaghetti-thin column of air that could be faintly heard in the frozen room. Seal moaned, Maddie rocked. Propelled by the sound, Maddie rocked her out of that bed, out of that room, into a blue vastness just underneath the sun and above time. She rocked her over Aegean seas so clean they shone like crystal, so clear the fresh blood of sacrificed babies torn from their mother's arms and given to Neptune could be seen like pink froth on the water. She rocked her on and on, past Dachau, where soul-gutted Jewish mothers swept their children's entrails off laboratory floors. They flew past the spilled brains of Senegalese infants whose mothers had dashed them on the wooden sides of slave ships. And she rocked on. She rocked her into her childhood and let her see murdered dreams. And she rocked her back, back into the womb, to the nadir of her hurt, and they found it, a slight, silver splinter embedded just above the surface, below the surface of the skin. And Maddie rocked and pulled, and the splinter gave way. But its roots were deep, gigantic, ragged, and they tore up flesh with bits of fat and muscle tissue clinging to them. They left a huge hole, which was already starting to pus over. But Maddie was satisfied. It would heal. Maddie drew a tub of hot water and undressed Seal. She let the nightgown fall off the narrow shoulders and over the pitifully thin breasts and jutting hip bones. She slowly helped her into the water, and it was like a dried brown autumn leaf hitting the surface of a puddle. And slowly she bathed her. She took the soap, and using only her hands, she washed Seal's hair in the back of her neck, under the toenails. She took Seal from the tub and toweled her in the same manner she had been bathed, as if too much friction would break the skin tissue. All of this had been done without either woman saying a word. Seal stood there, naked, and felt the cool air play against the clean surface of her skin. She had the sensation of fresh mint coursing through her pores. She closed her eyes and the fire was gone. Her tears no longer fried within her, killing her internal organs with their steam. So Seal began to cry, there, naked, in the center of the bathroom floor. The unmolested tears had rolled down her parted thighs and were beginning to wet the chair, but they were cold and good. She put out her tongue and began to drink in their saltiness, feeding on them. And she sobbed, the first sound she'd made since the moaning. Maddie took the edges of the dirty sheet she'd pulled off the bed and wiped the mucus that had been running out of Seal's nose. She then led her freshly wet, glistening body, baptized now, to the bed. She covered her with one sheet and laid a towel across the pillow. It would help for a while. And Seal lay down and cried. But Maddie knew the tears would end, and she would sleep, and morning would come. It's one of the most powerful passages, I think, in contemporary fiction, particularly because it takes Seal's pain and joins it to the pain of all mothers who have lost infants, who have lost children under these kinds of very difficult, oppressive circumstances, tragedies, all of them. And it universalizes the tragic moment. It does so from a mother's perspective. But I think added to that is the fact that Maddie is not this woman's mother, not her biological mother, but she mothers her in such a spiritual way that essentially, as you know, I think the word baptize comes as a most appropriate one when it does. She baptizes her into new life. She takes her from death into new life. And there are other, I think, very spiritual metaphors that are being used here, just in the tenderness of the bathing and so on. The rocking, too. You know, it's she rocks her back into her childhood. She has to take her back to the point where she can reconnect with her new life. Well, it remains a very powerful novel, and both Jerry and I have taught it several times. It's amazing how many students connect with this novel, African American or not. But I had one young man who didn't say a word in my freshman English class until we got to this novel. And there's a particular vignette in which Maddie's friend is trying to make time with the Baptist minister, and Charles said, all of a sudden he just exploded into speech. He said, that man's my, was it his father? I can't remember now. He knew this man inside out. It was a relative, if not his father, and he just became very articulate at that point because he had been taken to the center of an experience he knew quite well. For our poem, I thought maybe we could look at Enozaki Shange's closing of her choreo poem called For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. And again, this was published, well, now it's 15 years ago since it's been published, but it still remains quite powerful. Since we're discussing or considering cries of the spirit in this literature, I thought it would be good to look at the closing of this poem. Are any of you familiar with it? Have you seen it staged, or the women wear dresses of all the colors of the rainbow and brown, and all of these women have experienced abuse of one kind or another in their lives, fractured relationships, abortion, rape, all kinds of particularly difficult women's issues enter into this drama. The whole matter of self-esteem, education even enters in as a little girl discovers who Toussaint Louverture is, you know, and meets a little boy named Toussaint. She's certain that he's the hero she's read about in a storybook. It's a wonderful play. And at the end, this verse comes. I sat up one night walking a boarding house, screaming, crying, the ghost of another woman who was missing what I was missing. I wanted to jump out of my bones and be done with myself. Leave me alone and go on in the wind. It was too much. I fell into a numbness till the only tree I could see took me up in her branches, held me in the breeze, made me dawn dew, that chill at daybreak. The sun wrapped me up, swinging rose light everywhere. The sky laid over me like a million men. I was cold. I was burning up. A child, and endlessly weaving garments for the moon with my tears. I found God in myself, and I loved her. I loved her fiercely. This notion of finding God in oneself has been particularly important for women. And it really is set as a kind of balance to the God, the transcendent God who comes from outside, to recognize a God-like spirit within oneself, particularly if one has been so abused and told that you're essentially worthless. It's a very important recognition. So these women rescue themselves from death and depression by finding a sacredness within, by finding the holy within, and the capacity that they have to love and to nurture and protect becomes very important. Do any of you have comments about this brief little excerpt from, or a reaction to having seen the play? Melinda, do you remember when you saw it? Or
the one piece, and I may have just seen excerpts of it, but one piece was a woman she's talking about, that man walked off with all my
stuff. All of my stuff. That's
that was one that just. I mean, I under some of those stuff, I just didn't understand that they were saying that one. This happened to me before. You know, all my emotional stuff.
That's right.
I just love the way this language just throws images together and it gets right to the heart of it. I mean, skip the extra words. You don't need to make a sentence. Just
The speech is what we call the vernacular. The way that she that she prints it on the page, as Melinda is saying, is it too is choreographed in a way so that the speech becomes a dance. Mm-hmm. It's syncopated in parts. Just that segment, all of my stuff, the repetition of that really comes home. I remember too the vignette in which a very disturbed father is hanging his children by the heels out of the window, and the mother is protesting to him. That is such a powerful scene. I had one young woman come to a workshop once, and she had memorized this and presented it as a monologue. And at the end of it, no one could move. We were absolutely paralyzed with the force of that emotion. It's tremendous.
What I'm remembering of the production that we saw of it is how this is the very end of the play, and it's done as a chorus, almost like in a Greek play, mm-hmm. but it is so charged and energized, it is just an incredible celebration. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's celebration, it's creed, it's personal statement.
And a part of that creed, thank you for reminding me, Jerry, is that they all are out there, the colors of the rainbow, with brown right in the middle of that rainbow. And the idea is that they are creating hope for each other through their support. They've been very isolated and separated from one another, which brings us, of course, to the importance of telling these stories. Until you tell your story, you aren't going to know this other person who has a shared experience, and you have no way of gaining power or of asserting in the midst of all of that powerlessness that there is God within. You know, there is the sacred within that can bring you together, can continue to support you. It's such a powerful closing. And they sing it too, which is, and I'd love to do it for you right now, but this might be taped and I just can't risk it. Okay. Well, let's move on now to a couple of Chicana poets. And the first of these is Angela de Hoyos. That's spelled D-E-H-O-Y-O-S, but I'll be giving you her poem so you can see that. She's a bilingual writer and artist who was born in Mexico and now lives in San Antonio. And her paintings, she's a painter and a poet, are full of Aztec symbols, so she's beginning to draw from that spiritual past. And yet her lyrics are typical of a Chicana, as one critic has written, a bit ironic, agile, and resentful. So she writes a lot of verse of social protest, which is very important in the 60s and 70s and continues to be important at each stage of the movement. She's going to feign acceptance of the status quo exploitative practices of Anglo bosses, and then she'll come around to unleash her rebellion in lines which incite the Chicana to change her existence. And I have a poem here called The Final Laugh. How are we doing on time? Okay, good, yeah, just enough time.
Do Chicana writers prefer to be under that category of Chicana rather than mm-hmm. Latina or Hispanic? Mm-hmm. Is there any, we have a textbook in our school, Mexican American mm-hmm. writers. Do they find offense at any of those labels, or what is the?
It's pretty difficult for me to say, because I think it's in an almost continuous process of being changed. Mm-hmm. But the students at Cal Lutheran prefer to be called Chicanas or Latinas rather than Hispanics. We've had speakers who have made great jokes about his panic, you know, and coming from that community as if it were. But Chicana means Mexican American woman, so it would be inappropriate to apply to, for example, Julia Alvarez, who is a Dominican Republican woman.
Okay.
Then you would say Latina. Mm-hmm.
Chicana or Chicano is a deliberately chosen designation too, so it carries a lot of kind of social, political, cultural baggage with it. And
that's right.
I think the students that we're seeing are really for the first time claiming that name for themselves.
It grew out of the 60s.
Receiving it from that generation in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Because that was the...
The Chicano movement.
Right.
There was the creation of people who, you know, realized they were Latinos, Latinas, born in North America.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We had a powerful example of this just this spring at Cal Lutheran when Cesar Chavez's death occurred right before the acting troupe known as Teatro Campesino came to Cal Lutheran. And they were the troop that grew out of the picket lines that Chavez organized. So just a few people asked him, you know, if they could perform plays while the picket lines were going on, and it formed eventually into this group. And they're wonderful actors. We had a sort of a memorial for Chavez at that event, and you felt the power again resurging of the Chicano movement there. Okay, the final laugh. Who would like to read this poem? Does anyone know Spanish well enough to read the Spanish?
Mm.
Or to try it?
Practice it.
Would you try it, Lori?
In Spanish?
Mm-hmm.
I'll try. It's been a while. El estómago vacío con espasmo de mendigos ayeres. Me enfrento a mi reflejo en el oscuro espejo del atardecer. ¿Qué saben las entrañas de la necesidad de ser blanco, de la ventaja de padres escogidos, o de llevar en escarnecido desafío el fino trapo de orgullo étnico? Diciéndole a la carne estremecida y al reciente estómago. Paciencia, compañeros de mi dignidad, tal vez un día me acostumbre a esto, mis manos extendidas en eterna súplica, contentándose con los ojos del avaricioso dueño del poder. O quién sabe, tal vez mañana rompa las cadenas y me ande a mi talla a tu auténtica y lance en mi partida mi risa final, abrazmente insaciable, omnipotente, ajeno, mundo de los blancos.
Oh, I think you deserve some applause. Thank you. The final laugh. On an empty stomach, with the pang of mendicant yesterdays, I greet my reflection in the dark mirror of dusk. What do the entrails know about the necessity of being white? The advisability of mail order parents, or this wearing in mock defiance the thin rag of ethnic pride, saying to shivering flesh and grumbling belly, patience, O companions of my dignity. Perhaps someday I shall accustom myself to this, my hand held out in eternal supplication, being content with the leftovers of a greedy establishment, or who knows? Perhaps tomorrow I shall burst these shackles and, rising to my natural full height, fling the final parting laugh, O gluttonous, omnipotent, alien, white world. Do you have any comments about this poem?
He's seething within and he's putting up with it, but he doesn't know someday he might just bust out.
Mm-hmm. It's reminiscent in a way of Langston Hughes's poem, Dream Deferred, which actually comes as the epigraph to this book. Maybe I could just read that to remind us of what it says. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore, and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode? The sense of having been patient forever here, this eternal patience, how long can she count on that patience holding out? What are some of the images that you like that really help you get at her difficulty?
I'm interested in the third stanza, mm-hmm. with the thin rag of ethnic pride that where you are to take comfort in your dignity, mm-hmm. when really you don't have what you need to live.
Isn't that thin rag a very good image? I mean, you can just imagine how dignity is shivering under that thin rag. It's excellent.
I'm puzzled by mail order parents.
Okay.
You'd be smart. It'd be much better if you could order the parents that you wanted, so that you could be the color.
Yeah. The necessity of being white. You know, it reminds me of what... Dorothy was saying about all of the posters in the preschool she's checking out, you know, to see if there are any African Americans in these posters or any black children depicted in the books and so on. And, you know, mail order parents, why? Because these mail order catalogs, I don't know if you've noticed, but almost all of the models are white. And it's almost amusing to me that when they add African Americans, they really have what I call white features, you know, they're acceptable African Americans. That's what that image says to me. That
this poem really hits working as we are increasingly with first generation Latino students and watching the enormous conflicts of parents who are at the same time proud but very troubled by what this crossing over into this college means. And sometimes it takes very painful forms, especially for the Latinas who are expected to be at home and to be doing all of the work to keep the family cared for. And you can sense what a change is going to take place as they learn a little more about the necessity of being white just through their college experience, what a transformation that's going to be.
That's right. There's such a conflict between what they've come from and what those expectations were and what education is leading them toward. And just trying to keep both in some kind of tenuous balance is a tremendous challenge. The last line, Does it seem almost too heavy to you? Is there too much crowding in of adjectives here?
But that's the way it is.
I love the way she puts gluttonous before omnipotent and then follows it with alien, you know,
yeah,
so it's...
Yeah.
Okay, one more poem. This one by Sandra Cisneros, who is quite well known now for two novels. The House on Mango Street and Woman Hollering Creek. And I think she has another book coming out, which is listed here, My Wicked, Wicked Ways, which is... See, this is 92, so it came out in December. Sure.
About, you know, we can be poor and white, but to be poor and colored of a different term, actually, you know.
That's very true. I think that word gluttonous is very important because we've taken more than we needed. And in the last session, we talked about economic privilege it really does boil down to that in lots of ways. The fact that there's this greed, in a way, that we've become accustomed to, but economics based upon someone else's hunger.
And to call that alien, it really is alien to the earth itself.
It is. That's an alien I hadn't thought about. Well, Jerry and I have talked about the Chicano movement of the 1960s, but I don't want us to think that it just began there, because that was just the continuation of a long tradition of militants and resistance. The Chicanas, as we've said, have been questioning traditional notions of family, home, and sex roles. And this has been viewed as cultural betrayal. So the dilemma that confronts Chicanas is how to develop their full potential as women and fight sexism within their culture while retaining the racial and cultural identity that they have. You know, it's just very difficult to do both of those. I think that Sandra Cisneros, in Poema's preface, gets at this problem. In this poem, she talks about her choice to have poems instead of children. Now, if you live in a culture where, as a woman, your true definition comes through marriage and family, actually, I lived within such a culture, I think, that I thought that being a fulfilled woman and a successful woman meant marriage and children. At any rate, to write poems or to produce poems instead of children is some kind of betrayal, and so, as you very quickly figure out in this poem, she regards it as a sin.
Especially if you think of the Catholicism.
Yes, exactly, with the model there of the Virgin Mary and so on. And she begins it with two epigraphs. One I can quote, and the other one I'm going to ask Gloria again to read. "I can live alone, and I love to work." Mary Cassatt, the American painter who went off to France in order to paint and so on. Could you give us the other one by contact?
Ahí está el detalle.
There's the rub. "Gentlemen, ladies, if you please, these are my wicked poems from when? The girl grief decade, my wicked nun years, so to speak, I sinned. Not in the white woman way, not as Simone, voyeuring the pretty slum city on a golden arm. And no, not wicked like the captain of the bad boy blood, that Hollywood hoodlum who boozed and floozed it up, hell-bent on self-destruction. Not me. Well, not much. Tell me, how does a woman like me, daughter of a daddy with a hammer and blistered feet, he'd dip into a washtub when he ate his dinner, a woman with no birthright in the matter, what does a woman inherit that tell her how to go? My first felony I took up with poetry. For this penalty the rice burned. Mother warned I'd never wife. Wife? A woman like me whose choice was rolling pin or factory? An absurd vice, this wicked wanton writer's life. I chucked the life my father plucked for me, leapt into the salamander fire. A girl who'd never roam beyond her father's rooster eye, winched the door with poetry and fled. For good, and grieved I gone when I was so alone. In my kitchen in the thin hour, a calendar cassette chanted, repeat after me, I can live alone and I love to, what a crock, each week the ritual grief, that decade of the knuckled knocks. I took the crooked route and liked my badness, played at mistress, tattooed an ass, lapped up my happiness from a glass. It was something, at least. I hadn't a clue. What does a woman willing to invent herself at 22 or 29 do? A woman with no who nor how. And how was I to know what was unwise? I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be happy. What's that at 20 or 29? Love, baby, husband, the works. The big palookas of life, wanting and not wanting. Take your hands off me. I left my father's house before the brothers vagabonded the globe like a rich white girl, got a flat. I paid for it. I kept it clean. Sometimes the silence frightened me. Sometimes the silence blessed me. It would come get me late at night, open like a window, hungry for my life. I wrote when I was sad. The flat cold, when there was no love, new, old, to distract me. No six brothers with their Fellini racket. No mother, father, with their wives, I told you. I tell you, these are the pearls from that 10-year itch, my jewels, my colicky kids, who fussed and kept me up the wicked nights, when all I wanted was, with nothing in the text to tell me. But that was then. The who I was, who would become the who I am. These poems are from that hobbled when. I think there's a wonderful use of rhyme in this poem. It just punctuates the satire in a way, what she's trying to expose here, both in herself and in the cultural context from which she comes. Well, we might, we could close it right now if you're ready to go, or we might take a couple minutes for comments. Do you have a couple minutes? Okay. Who would like to start with a comment here about a part of this poem?
A very strong woman to be able to lead that kind of life.
I think so too. Mm-hmm. Because it means certainly isolation, alienation. It's painful.
I took the crooked route.
Why do you think she describes herself essentially as a slut for taking up with poetry?
Well, you're supposed to belong to a man.
So
she's chosen something different. She's gone off a whore.
It just seems like almost an extreme metaphor to use, though, doesn't it?
Well, it tells me that her life is very different from my life, because I mean, a lot of people who have pursued a career have chosen that over something else and basically lost time. But the cost of her...